Top stories, the European Union slams as deeply disappointing a decision by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to delay the first Palestinian elections in 15 years. India registers a record single day of over 386,000 new cases of the coronavirus and nearly 3,500 new deaths from the disease. Also ahead, the UN warns that nearly half of the population in Myanmar risks falling into poverty by 2022 due to the impacts of the coronavirus and the country's political crisis. Welcome to the program. Our top story, the European Union has condemned a decision by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to postpone the first Palestinian election in 15 years. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell called the decision deeply disappointing. He said a new date should be set without delay. Legislative and presidential elections were due to be held on May the 22nd and July the 31st, respectively. But on Friday, Palestinian President Abbas delayed them. He cited a lack of assurances by Israel that voting would take place in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Various Palestinian groups criticized the move. Resistance movement Hamas called the decision a coup against its partnership with Abbas's party, Fatah. Hamas has expected to do better than Fatah in this polls. India has logged yet another record daily rise in its coronavirus cases as it faces severe shortages of medical supplies. The health ministry on Friday registered over 386,400 new cases in 24 hours. That takes India's total tally to more than 18 million, the second largest in the world. The country has been posting record after record in its daily COVID cases in the past few weeks. That has been blamed on large gatherings as well as people's reluctance to wear masks. The explosion in infections has caused a severe shortage in hospital beds and supplies of oxygen. A number of countries have pledged aid and assistance to India. The U.S. aid has just arrived there. Well, we earlier talked to our New Delhi correspondent Munawar Zaman about the coronavirus crisis in his country. He told us how tragic the situation is as the country is grappling with an explosion in cases.
Well, the hospitals have broken down. They're overwhelmed. There is nothing they can do. They're trying their hard to save as much as life they can, and you wouldn't imagine. They have to make a choice whom to give the oxygen, whom to give the ventilator. I mean, they have to make the decisions in seconds, depending on whose conditions is what. I mean, the situation is out of words. There is no word that can describe the situation. Till yesterday, we were talking about shortage of oxygen supplies and shortage of beds. Now, that's something which is not to be spoken about now. Now, the biggest trouble the country is facing is the lack of crematoriums, lack of food, lack of burial grounds. I mean, it is the biggest trouble now the country is facing, because people have to queue up to get their loved ones buried, to get their loved ones cremated, because there is no space left.
Germany has reported more than 24,300 new cases from coronavirus in the past 24 hours. The figure declined by 400 compared with the daily case tally that was reported on Thursday. Germany's total cases are now over 3.38 million, with nearly 83,000 deaths. On Thursday, Health Minister Jens Spahn said the number of infections seems to be heading lower, but he added the decline is not yet deep enough to suggest that the third wave of the pandemic has been broken. Germany's efforts to contain the third wave is complicated by the more contagious UK variant and a relative slow start to its vaccination campaign. Officials say few cases of the Indian variant have also been detected. Meanwhile, Brazil registers more than 3,000 new COVID-19 fatalities as the country's overall death toll surpasses the grim milestone of 400,000. The U.S. is the only country where the coronavirus has claimed more lives. The Brazilian Health Ministry also recorded nearly 70,000 additional infections, raising total cases to more than 14.5 million. Health experts have warned the daily toll could remain high for several months as the Latin American country struggles to secure enough vaccines while loosening restrictions. Elsewhere in the Americas region, Mexico has reported 529 new deaths from the virus, along with some 4,000 more confirmed cases. With the onslaught of the coronavirus pandemic last year came an increase in hostility and racial abuse against Asians, and the Chinese community in Britain was no exception. Saipuriza reports some of the abuse has been leveled against the very people putting their own lives on the line to save others.
The COVID-19 pandemic has led to a sharp rise in racism against Asians, hate crimes against Chinese, East and Southeast Asians, and the horrific Atlanta shootings in the U.S. threw the topic into stark relief. In Britain, too, violence against Asians has become a bigger problem than it already was. According to one statistic, hate crimes against Asians in Britain increased fourfold in the first quarter of last year, a trend that continues to this day.
I was in my eye test appointment, and there was two spaces between me, and every single people that came didn't choose to sit next to me.
I feel unsafe when I'm by myself, so I just like listen to the music. But you know, some people are still gonna say something when they see Asian people.
Before there were any lockdowns, the Chinese and other ethnic communities had already been suffering abuse as a result of fear and misunderstanding stoked by internet conspiracies. Then came former U.S. President Donald Trump pointing the finger of blame for the pandemic at China.
Many of the victims have started telling their stories on social media, where they're receiving increasing attention. Among them, a growing number of Asian healthcare workers, such as this nurse, racially abused by a patient whose very life he was helping save.
Racism does exist in our society. It's mirrored colonialism. Britain has been the largest colonial power, arguably, for the last 200 to 300 years, and an ideology that particularly came with the Victorians has risen to reflect that, one of European supremacy, and particularly British supremacy and white supremacy.
The thought of the UK being unsafe is a sentiment shared by British Asian healthcare workers. Some have thought of moving elsewhere, but have had to stay because of the pandemic-imposed restrictions on travel and immigration.
A disproportional number of them, drawn especially from overseas, who trained overseas, find themselves in subordinate positions within in the NHS. So despite their skill, despite their education, they're less likely to be in substantive consultant positions. They're more likely to be at staff grade, at sub-consultant level, career grade, to find it hard to progress. So there's like a glass ceiling.
The easing or lifting of lockdown measures should ordinarily come as exciting news for many. But for the Asian community in Britain, among them frontline healthcare professionals, the bitter experiences of the past year will continue to impact their lives for years to come. Saipuriza, London.
While the UN has warned about rising poverty in Myanmar in the wake of the country's political crisis and the COVID-19 pandemic, a report by the UN Development Programme says poverty could affect up to 25 million people in Myanmar by 2022. That amounts to nearly half of the population there. The report says the number of people living under the poverty line has increased by 11% in the last year due to the pandemic. Now the rate could grow by a further 12% by early next year because of the political crisis. The turmoil began in February when Myanmar's military staged a coup and ousted civilian rulers. Welcome to this hour's On the News Line. During his first address to Congress, the U.S. President said he will make sure that America will not lose in the geopolitical competition against its rivals. Joe Biden's remarks are seen as a warning to Russia and China. But will America be able to contain other superpowers?
During his term in office, former U.S. President Donald Trump kept boasting about his tough line on China. Trump imposed unprecedented trade sanctions on Chinese companies. His administration also raised military tensions with Beijing over Taiwan and in the South China Sea, where Beijing has many territorial claims. Some observers went so far as to warn that Trump's dangerous policies pushed the two sides to the brink of conflict. Trump's successor, Joe Biden, has been widely expected to change course. Under Biden, America seems to have toned down anti-China rhetoric. But the geopolitical rivalry between the two global arch-rivals remains intense. Biden's administration has made clear that it will stick to the aggressive trade policies followed by the previous administration against Beijing. This week, in his first speech to a joint session of Congress, Biden talked tough on China. During his address, the U.S. president left no doubt that America will do its utmost to outpace the Asian superpower in terms of trade and technology.
We will defend America's interests across the board. America will stand up to unfair trade practices that undercut American workers and American industries, like subsidies from state to state-owned operations and enterprises, and the theft of American technology and intellectual property.
Biden identifies China as the toughest foreign policy challenge facing America. The U.S. president also said the American military will maintain a strong presence in the Indo-Pacific, where the U.S. has been trying to contain the growing influence of its arch-rival. Meanwhile, the U.S. president seems to be more serious than his predecessor in trying to contain America's other geopolitical rival, Russia.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump was usually accused of being too soft on Russia, but Biden made it clear during his speech this week that Moscow will face a response for what America accuses it of doing, namely interference in U.S. elections.
America views Russia as the second most serious threat after China. While Trump tried to avoid penalizing Russia on the world stage, in his first 100 days in office, Biden imposed two new sets of sanctions on Moscow and expelled nearly a dozen Russian diplomats from the U.S. Biden said this week that he had made clear to Russian President Vladimir Putin that Moscow's influence in U.S. elections and cyber attacks on government and businesses would not go unanswered.
The line that Biden has taken already has been, I think, more aggressive than Trump. Trump was not very happy with this campaign against Russia. This was run by the Democrats. They were doing the so-called Russiagate to try and get rid of Donald Trump. But Biden is probably more inclined to put the clamps on Russia than even Trump was.
The U.S. has repeatedly accused the Russian government of cyber attacks and other covert hostile actions. Russia has always denied such allegations. The American president, however, stressed that Washington does not seek escalation with the Russian Federation. Meanwhile, planning is underway for Putin and Biden to sit down for talks as soon as early summer. Analysts believe top on the agenda of their meeting will probably be the volatile situation in Ukraine, where Russia and the West have been locked in a tug of war for years. Biden has energetically talked about his foreign policy plans and his favorite ways of countering the threats posed by America's main adversaries. But it's probably too soon to know whether he will deliver on his promises of containing America's arch-rivals. The two seem determined to try to erode Washington's influence wherever they can.
Colombian protesters and riot police have clashed on the second day of demonstrations against the tax reform package proposed by the government. Clashes broke out in various locations, including the city of Cali. Reports say one person died there in what was called an incident related to the demonstration. Colombians took to the streets in major cities Thursday for the second straight day. They defied a court order ruling that the marches should be postponed because of a spike in COVID cases. The government has said it will act against the demonstrators breaking the law. The proposed reform would increase taxes on individuals and businesses and eliminate many exemptions. Now, Kyrgyzstan says its death toll from the latest border clashes with Tajikistan has climbed to 13. According to the Kyrgyz Health Ministry, scores were also injured in the clashes. The country says over 10,000 citizens have been evacuated from two districts where the fighting was intense. Tajikistan has said two people were injured in the violence. On Thursday, security forces from the two countries exchanged fire and residents hurled rocks at one another in a clash over a water reservoir. The two sides announced a ceasefire later on that day, but shooting was reported during its night. Over a third of the border between Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan is disputed. U.S. President Joe Biden has been interrupted by a group of protesters as he began a rally in Georgia. They called on him to close private detention centers.
I want to thank you, the people of Georgia.
End detention now! End detention now!
We'll give you a microphone.
No! End detention now!
Folks!
Biden responded, "I agree with you. Give me another 5 days." In January, the U.S. president signed an executive order that ended federal use of private prisons. Democrats hailed the move as an important step, but there have been calls for more action. Opponents of private detention centers say the facilities are linked with racial injustice. They also say the centers perpetuate mass imprisonment. And that's it with international news.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Forty recommendations by Imam Khamenei for the journey towards God. Be ambitious. Be ambitious when making dua. Ask for great things. Ask for prosperity in the world and the hereafter, and do not consider it too great or too much. No, for God, these are trivial. What matters is that you ask sincerely and under these conditions. God will fulfill this kind of request. Sometimes you would not even know that what happens is the answer to your prayers. You may be totally unaware. The most readily available benefit. Dua is not only for a time of plight. You should always pray. Some might think that they are only supposed to pray at times of difficulty and plight. No, even during normal times of life, one should pray and keep the relation with God intact. The euphemism used in hadith is that your voice should become familiar to the angels. Dua is always necessary. The greatest benefit of dua is its most readily available one, which directly affects the person praying. This is the creation of a relation with God and the feeling of love and enthusiasm to get close to God. This is the most readily available benefit of dua which benefits you. Your request in dua being satisfied is another matter.
يا خير زاد رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان 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 ليتك دوما قريب
The chance of one's dua being accepted. Duas do not have to contradict natural laws and go against them. Dua is accepted and your request is satisfied within the framework of natural laws. It is the power of God to unify the laws and arrange them in a way that fulfills your request. Although, there are examples of laws being overshadowed by dua. But this does not mean that if your prayers contradict other divine laws and are not accompanied by action, and the prayers are even void of attention, they will be satisfied. No. Praying needs to be with asking from God and requires pleading. This kind of dua will be answered. If this kind of dua is accompanied by action and effort, then this dua has a better chance of being accepted. If prayer is repeated several times without being answered, you should not get disappointed, especially in important matters, and in particular when it is about the fate of man, the country or nations, because sometimes great projects naturally need more time to be realized.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
And a global war later, Israel is still not able to neutralize its front line with Damascus.
With more than 500 illegal Israeli strikes on different parts of Syria, an Iron Dome recognized as the most effective on the planet, and yet Syria's missiles landed in the occupied Naqab Desert near the infamous Dimona. What is even more interesting is that the Israeli occupation regime immediately deemed that this was not an attack, but rather an errant Syrian anti-aircraft missile that had been fired at an Israeli jet during an airstrike on targets in the Syrian Golan Heights. Humor me here. I will give you a timeline of what we know happened, but then I have some simple questions. The Syrian Ministry of Defense announced that its air defenses had responded to an aggression carried out by the Israeli entity against Syrian Arab Army targets near Damascus. Syria's air defenses dropped most of the Israeli missiles. Less than an hour later, at 2 a.m. on Thursday, April 22, incoming rocket sirens were triggered in the northern Naqab Desert in the area near Israel's Dimona nuclear reactor, followed by massive explosions that could be heard throughout much of occupied Palestine. At 3 a.m., Israel's occupation forces spokesperson Jonathan Conricus told Reuters that an errant Syrian missile struck the area around Dimona, but the reactor was not hit by the strike. Now, can someone explain to me how a surface-to-air missile can travel a distance of 250 kilometers from Damascus to Dimona all the way in the occupied Naqab Desert? And why did Israeli jets conduct a second round of airstrikes in Syria after this errant missile landed a few kilometers away from their secret nuclear plant site? And how much of a coincidence was it that a powerful explosion rocked an Israeli missile factory near occupied Al-Quds just hours before the Dimona incident? We'll try answering these questions right here on the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Sirens went off in Dimona town in the Palestinian-occupied Naqab Desert in the early hours of Thursday, April 22, which is home to Israel's infamous nuclear reactor, indicating a possible incoming attack. A missile landed only a few kilometers away from the Dimona plant, which Israel immediately deemed as a missile that has lost its track from the Syrian side. Supposedly, it was a surface-to-air missile that was targeting an Israeli jet raiding Damascus and ended up somehow falling 250 kilometers away from its initial target. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mohammed Abed, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Mohammed. Now, Israel immediately declared hours after the missile landed near Dimona that it was an errant Syrian missile, while Syria only officially declared that it fired anti-aircraft missiles against the Israeli jet that was targeting Damascus at that time. Was the Israeli scenario of a missile that lost its track some 250 kilometers away from the initial target a plausible one for you?
Well, no, to say, tell you the truth. It's not even, I think, plausible to many people in the world. Any observer would note that this range of error, if we are to call it this way, would stop us against believing. And the issue that we had a previous case in which an errant surface-to-air missile landed near the Lebanese-Palestinian borders. So to have this range of error, which is about 250 kilometers, I think this weakens the whole story. And the issue of that the Israelis are not even publishing anything about it in today's press, for instance, and just had one unified scenario that is not that much acceptable for a missile that would lose its way. And so. So from many angles, you don't find this as a plausible narrative.
Well, Mr. Mohammed, many serious questions are clashing right now at the decision-making tables inside of the Israeli entity. The main question is the nature of this so-called incident, as the Israelis are calling it, and the objectives behind it. What do you think was the main objective of hitting so close to Dimona?
Well, you have to take into account all the players that are engaged in this sort of conflict, which is sometimes on a low fire, but sometimes tensions heighten and we see explosions, for instance, like the one we saw on this very day, within 24 hours of the incident of the missile. I mean, the Tamir facility, which is a factory of manufacturing missiles near residential areas, by the way, there was an explosion that was taped on by many on phones, and the images, the footage toured the world. I mean, you can see it very easily, but still nobody talks about this anymore. You have to take into account this conflict, which is basically taking place between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Israeli entity. You have a factory that manufactures missiles and do some tests, and the closeness, as I mentioned earlier, to the residential areas. You had this case of an explosion of a test, which remains a little, not a little, a lot of questions are raised about it.
Mind you, it happened just hours before the actual missile that landed near Dimona.
Yes. And we come back to the missile. So here you have to take all the players. I mean, the Islamic Republic, Syria. Is Syria trying to change the rules of engagement? As for the Israelis, whenever they like, are launching aggressions on Syria and doing so. Are the Iranians, and they don't want to declare it, taking revenge as for the attacks of Natanz and other Israeli aggressions within Iran or against Iranian targets? So you have to take into account all the players within this very live conflict that we see now.
Mm-hmm. Well, another question hovers around the Israeli intelligence and their defense capabilities, which were utter failure, very much of a failure following the landing of the missile at, quote, the safest place in the world. This is what the Dimona mayor is saying. When on the same day, you just explained to us, just maybe it's not the same day, just hours before, on Wednesday afternoon, we saw this huge explosion in the occupied Jerusalem area, which Israel's claimed it's an accident that has happened inside of a missile factory inside its territories. How do you think this issue is being maybe discussed behind the closed doors, especially of the Israeli intelligence ones?
Yes, if we weren't within a case of enmity with the Israelis, we'd say, may God help them. Now, they are facing a lot of catastrophes, the attacks that they are launching whenever they want are backfiring. Now, we saw that all the Iron Dome and whatever they call the Arrow missile interception and so, are failing in the face of one missile. So what is the case when hundreds, let's say the least, or thousands maybe, of missiles land on the Palestinian occupied territories that are now occupied by the Israelis? So if these systems could not deal with one missile, so what is the case if hundreds of missiles are launched? And I'd like also to comment on this issue of the safest place in the world. I mean, mm-hmm. How can it be as such if you cannot prevent and intercept one missile? What is the case when you have, and this is a main geopolitical change that we've seen within the past 10 years. In the past, Israel used to launch aggressions against all the countries around the Palestine, I mean, and they would have no reaction for that. They could do whatever they want. But now we see that they are not able even to launch an aggression against Gaza, against Lebanon. And now maybe we are witnessing a change of rules of engagement. As for this missile, whoever is the one that the party that launched it, probably we will no longer see Israeli attacks against Syria that go unpunished. So all this within the region is taking place. Also, we have to take into account the negotiations that are taking place, the indirect negotiations between the Islamic Republic and the United States, and the Israelis being unpleasant about it at all, mm-hmm. and they are all expressing their that they do not want the return to the agreement, nuclear agreement.
Hence, so why we saw a lot of clashes, maybe some sort of a shadowy Cold War between Israel and Iran in the Mediterranean and the Red Sea. But the failure specifically here inside of the occupied Palestinian territories occupied by the Israeli entity, the failure of the Patriot system to intercept that supposedly surface-to-air missile, we are not sure, and experts are saying that is not even the case here, but the failure of this system, which now just is some sort of an additional loophole to the Israeli intercepting system that is said to be the most effective in the world. We are seeing here Syria and its allies, an entire axis of resistance building upon this incident, having more options on the table, on their own table. Are we at a new phase of countering Israeli attacks against any component of the allied forces of the resistance in West Asia?
Yes, probably we will be seeing this change in the political and in the situation on the ground. As I told you earlier, in the past, I mean, you used to have Israel come and raid Lebanon whenever they wanted. The Palestinian Gaza Strip was not liberated then, but after the liberation also they launched aggressions whenever they want. So this serves the theory of those who say that the Israelis will not be deterred unless you use force against them. And this is one thing that we probably are witnessing nowadays. Now, if you are, imagine yourself one of those who are in the think tanks or in the people who are decision-making within the Israeli entity, and you are facing such a situation. In the past, you used to do whatever you want. Now you cannot even launch aggression against the weakest party, as you said, because Syria now, because of the universal aggression that took place against it, this universal war that was supported by at least 80 countries against Syria. So Syria is now the weakest part of the axis of the resistance. So now Syrians probably will be preventing Israel from launching an aggression. This may lead us to another point, which is more strategic. Mm-hmm. The first creation of Israel was to be the West's barracks in the region. And even, by the way, President Biden said this while he was explaining why he supports Israel. Mm-hmm. He said it is cheaper than having any war ship in the Mediterranean, for instance.
Well, it remains to be seen what will happen next, Mr. Muhammad, especially that the U.S. military itself is being rained upon by missiles inside of Iraq. They can't get a hold of themselves. They want to try and get hold of their own airline here. That's going to be a big issue and a big challenge for them. And I want to thank you very much, Muhammad Abed, political commentator, for being with us to talk about this attack on Dimona, which Israel is deeming just a missile that lost track. Stay with us. Next, we will be talking about the Revolutionary Guard's drone footage that is showing the U.S. aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard has released precise drone footage of a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf, aired on Press TV on Wednesday. The video, which shows the aircraft carrier with warplanes, helicopters, and other military equipment, was reportedly recorded by a four-strong drone squadron, providing real-time and precise details of the U.S. warship. The video comes as the U.S. is still refusing to remove all sanctions off of the Iranian population, as renewed diplomacy are underway to revive the abandoned 2015 nuclear deal. More details about that in this following report. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard released drone footage of a U.S. aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf and a clip of a bomber drone test flight on Wednesday, at a time when the Vienna-based talks between world powers to revive the 2015 nuclear deal were underway. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard released strikingly precise and close footage of the American aircraft carrier captured by the elite forces' drones during an overflight of the vessel in the Persian Gulf, vividly portraying its state-of-the-art advancements in the field of drone technology. The footage was undated, but was described by regional media as showing remarkably close details of warplanes and other military aircraft and equipment on the U.S. aircraft carrier. The second part of the footage, entitled Precision Attacks by the Revolutionary Guards, showed kamikaze drones as they are hitting various targets, including a tank. The UAVs are seen slamming into the targets with surgical accuracy and smashing them into fragments. It is not the first time the Islamic Revolutionary Guard displayed its achievements and prowess in drone technology. However, this video was broadcasted on Iranian outlets at a time when the U.S. is still refusing to remove all sanctions off of the Iranian population as renewed diplomacy are underway to revive the abandoned 2015 nuclear deal. Diplomats from Britain, China, France, Germany, Iran, and Russia have been meeting regularly since earlier this month to discuss reviving the 2015 nuclear deal, while U.S. diplomats are participating indirectly in the talks. Tehran firmly refuses any direct talks with the U.S. before all sanctions are lifted, and the result of the lifting is felt by the government and the people. The Islamic Republic has made it clear that it would by no means settle for the suspension, easing, or extending the waiver of sanctions, repeating what Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has always echoed. The bans should be removed in their entirety, and Iran will wait to verify of the sanctions removal before returning to its nuclear obligations under the deal. Now to discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Dr. Hamed Mousavi, political science professor at Tehran University. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Mousavi. Now, what is the Islamic Republic of Iran trying to say by showing this drone footage of the U.S. Aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf at a time when before we even mentioned the nuclear deal, at a time when the regional waters are witnessing a shadowy cold war between Iran and Israel?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a show of strength by Iran. Iran essentially is trying to say that if it is attacked, it has the capacity to respond both to Israeli forces as well as American forces in the region. And from Tehran's perspective, the attack that happened in Natanz, the Americans were also shared a responsibility for it, even though they denied any involvement. We have to remember that even if the Americans were not directly involved, the Israelis, I think they got a green light from the Americans. This happened, the attack on Natanz happened exactly when the U.S. Secretary of Defense was meeting Israeli officials, and the Americans, after the attack, did not denounce the attack or they did not criticize Israel. They only specified that they weren't directly responsible. So from Tehran's perspective, if Iran comes under attack, then it has the capacity to respond to both the Americans as well as the Israelis.
Well, another aspect of the video that was released by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps showed kamikaze drones hitting various targets, including one tank, with very much accurate targets, showcasing Iran's state-of-the-art technology in the field of drones. It is worth mentioning that this video was released just 1 week after the Israeli Natanz attack and just 1 day before the Dimona attack inside of the Israeli territory, obviously the occupied Palestinian territories, too. Though the plant was allegedly not hit, we have no evidence of that. Is this phase two of this shadowy war, this shadowy cold war, if you will, between Israel, or rather just another threat against U.S. presence in the region in general?
Well, I think Iran is trying to show that it has asymmetrical capabilities in responding to both the Israelis as well as the Americans. I don't think we can really distinguish between the Americans and the Israelis, even in this Biden administration, because the Americans have been very much supportive of Israeli policy in the region, and we haven't seen any real changes regarding the Trump administration's policy towards Israel. So in that regard, the fact that the Israelis as well as the Americans have been attacking Iran on various fronts has really escalated the situation. I don't think Iran wants a regional war here. In fact, Iran has showed a lot of, if you will, it has shown a lot of restraint in the past year. We had the assassination of Iranian scientists at the end of December. We had the attack on Natanz, which happened actually less than a year before another attack on the same Iranian facilities. And during all this time, Iran has actually been trying to calm the situation. But at the same time, I think Iran wants to show that if push comes to shove, then it does have the capability to respond. Regarding the attack near Dimona, first of all, it's important to note that Israel's Iron Dome system was not able to intercept the missile. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it missed the Dimona plant, I think maybe it was on purpose. I think the aim was not to hit Dimona, but was rather to show that there is the capability, either by Iran or Hezbollah, mm-hmm. to target sensitive Israeli systems if, in fact, a war should start between Iran and Israel.
Dr. Moussaoui, the timing of the drone footage coincided with the ongoing meetings in Vienna between Britain, China, France, Germany, Iran, and Russia, who were there to discuss reviving the 2015 nuclear deal. But would such footage bring a leverage to the Iranian position, or rather would very much maybe hurt the talks at this time?
Well, I think the Israeli attack on Natanz had maybe two purposes. One was to derail the talks, because we know the Israelis do not want the talks to reach an agreement. But at the same time, I think the Israelis were trying to establish leverage for the Americans, and the fact that they were trying to hurt Iran's enrichment capabilities. But in reality, the attack actually had a reverse effect, because right after the attack, Iran started enrichment of 60%, essentially giving Iran leverage in the talks with the Americans. And the fact that these kinds of footage, as well as the attack on Dimona, is showing is that Iran is not a weak regional player here. It does have the means and the capabilities to respond. The fact that it has not responded in a forceful manner is because Iran does not want war. Nevertheless, we have to remember that restraint from the Iranian side cannot hold on forever. The Biden administration has to understand that if they don't bar the Israelis from such kind of attacks, then there is a very real possibility of war in the region. Mm-hmm. And this is a very dangerous scenario.
We are seeing that U.S. diplomats are not participating directly in these talks because Tehran firmly refuses any direct talks with the U.S. before all sanctions are lifted, and the result of lifting of that those sanctions are felt by both the government and the nation, the people of Tehran. What are Iran's options in the event that the U.S. refuses to lift the sanctions, then rather choose instead to ease those sanctions?
Well, I think from Iran's position specified by Ayatollah Khamenei is that unless the U.S. Lifts all the sanctions in one step, then Iran will not reach an agreement with them. And on the surface, this might seem like a harsh stance, but we have to remember the history of the past few years from Iran's perspective. When the nuclear deal was reached in 2015, it was under the assumption that Iran would limit its nuclear program, and in return it would receive economic incentives. But what happened was, especially during the Trump administration, the Americans left the deal very easily. And for a whole year, Iran fully obliged by its side of the deal, and this was in response to promises by the Europeans that Iran would still receive the sanctions lifting incentives that were specified in the deal. In reality, Iran never received such benefits. Actually, Iran is selling less oil today than it was before the deal was signed in 2015. So, if anything, Iran is worse off today than it was before the deal. Mm-hmm. And because of that, today Iran is saying that the Americans are not trustworthy. And unless they lift all sanctions at once, and Iran is able to verify that, so it's not only on paper, but they can actually verify that the sanctions have been lifted, then Iran does not really have any incentives to return to the deal. I think that's the real situation here. And because of that, I don't think we are going to see a breakthrough in the talks anytime soon, because the Biden administration is not really showing any flexibility so far.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Hamid Mousavi, political science professor at Tehran University, for talking to us about how the Islamic Revolutionary Guard released these drone footage of the U.S. aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf, and how would that affect the talks, or the indirect talks, between the U.S. and Iran in Vienna for reviving the 2015 nuclear talks. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Subhanallah walhamdulillah. La ilaha illallah wallahu akbar. La ilaha illallah.
Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah. Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of the month of Allah. In this part of the program, we're going to talk about some famous reciters in the world of Islam. For today's program, we'll be talking about the great Quran reciter and Mubtahid, the person who recites supplications and eulogizes the Prophet and his family, Sheikh Muhammad Imran. Sheikh Muhammad Imran, this great Mubtahid and reciter, was born in 1944 in Sawhaj Governorate of Egypt. When he was 1 year old, he went blind. Nevertheless, he managed to memorize the whole Quran at the age of 10 under the care of Sheikh Abdul Rahim al-Masri. Afterwards, he learned the rules of Tajweed under the care of Sheikh Mahmoud Khabbaz. When he was 11 years old, he moved to Cairo, and it was there that he became familiar with many reciters and munshids in Egypt. Sheikh Muhammad Imran followed the style of Sheikh Ali Mahmoud in the field of Inshad and Ibtihad. Nevertheless, he was a very good reciter of the Quran who had a very good tajweed, and his knowledge of maqamat was spectacular. He was such a talented and skilled reciter in using the maqamat that his knowledge of maqamat is extremely high. For example, he was able to move from one maqam to another maqam, or he could combine several maqams with one another. Maqam means the specific melodies that are used for reciting the Quran, because as you know, the Qur'an is recited melodiously by reciters of the Qur'an. Sheikh Muhammad Imran believed that not all mubtahils and munshids have the qualification to perform in the radio. Why is that? Because he said that first, they have to be good reciters of the Quran. They should have good tajweed, just like himself. Sheikh Muhammad Imran, when he recited the Quran, his tajweed was almost perfect. His fasaha was exceptional. And that is why he advised all of the reciters, all the mubtahils, to first become good reciters and then become mubtahils. And that is why he said that Sheikh Muhammad al-Hilbawi and Sheikh Saeed Hafil were qualified to perform in the radio. Now, with this introduction, let's go ahead and listen to the recitation of Sheikh Muhammad Imran, Surah Al-Ma'idah, verse 109.
Be warned of the day when Allah will assemble the messengers and say, "What was the response you received?" They will say, "We have no knowledge. Indeed, it is you who is the knower of the unseen."
We give people
U.S. police lethal force.
Guilty, guilty, guilty. Former Minneapolis officer Derek Chauvin was finally found guilty of all of the charges against him, including third-degree murder. And that happened nearly a year after the footage of him kneeling on George Floyd's neck shocked everyone in the world.
Today, you have the cameras all around the world to see and show what happened to my brother. It was a motion picture the world seeing his life being extinguished. And I could do nothing but watch. Especially in that courtroom, over and over and over again, as my brother was murdered. Times, they're getting harder every day.